Hello, everyone. This is Robert Stark. My guest for today is Paul Bingham. Hey, Paul, nice having you on.
Thank you for having me, Robert.
So you have a new book out. It's called Down Where the Devil Don't Go, and it's published by Nine Banded Books.
Yeah, it's just come out this month, I believe. It's my first book.
And I guess you can talk about the overall theme of the book, but the theme of the book is it's about men at war.
Well, we put the kind of the description of it is called Sardonic Tales of Men at War, with various aspects of themselves or the world around them. I was kind of telling Chip Smith, the publisher, my publisher and editor of these stories, that I felt that the four stories kind of worked together, and Chip was probably the first editor I came across who recognized that I had written these stories and kind of tied them in to each story is kind of tied to each to the next one in some fashion. There's certain connections that the reader can find that each story has, but moreover, one of the points of the stories is that each one demonstrates a different kind of men. There are two men of action in these stories, and there are two men who are naturally not active types and who are more inclined to act in a less masculine fashion to get their point across or to accomplish their aims. And so basically I compare it to a work by Mishima. It's unintentional, but Mishima demonstrates various types of men in one of his collections of short stories. I just remember which one it was, but different types of men in conflict with one another, and or with not in with one another, but with different, again, aspects or parts of themselves or with other individuals. For example, in one of his stories, it's about an actor who is a bodybuilder and basic and also a kept man, a gigolo for a wealthy mafia-type woman. And in that, Mishima explores the actor's interest in narcissism and sadomasochism. And in the case of my stories, we have a similar thing going on where he has an actor who is a bodybuilder and he has a boxer and he has a businessman and he has one other figure I just remember, but essentially two men of action and two men of commerce or letters or what have you. And mine, I have a writer, I have a Hollywood producer, and I have a ex-bodyguard, what have you, in my detective story, What the Dead Men Fear. And I also have a ex-soldier who has returned from Iraq with post-traumatic syndrome. And he's remembering all those things that have gone on in Iraq, and essentially things end well for the two desk men, comparatively well, and particularly poorly for the two men of action. And that's often the case because a man finds in this world today, you'll see those signs quite often: death rather than dishonor. And very few people intend to act on those signs in any way, shape, or form. But the protagonists, the men of action in those two stories, I feel all right. And What the Dead Men Fear, feel that death is, in fact, preferable to dishonor.
Before, I'd like to get into some of the stories in a little more detail, if that's okay. But before I get to that, I'd like to ask you, so what originally attracted you to Chip Smith's Nine Banded Books?
I wrote these stories I call Americana stories because I was very unhappy with the state of short stories in 2005, 2006. And so I wrote Americana stories, which I wanted to create figures that seemed more like the type of individual that actually existed in the world today, and not a character that was created by a college professor who they seem to be the only kind of people writing short stories these days. If you ever catch up with the best American short story anthologies, which are often edited by academics, you'll find that they're very dreary reading, very liberal, very left-wing, and mainly boring. That's their capital sin in my book, and completely out of touch. So I wanted to write these stories, and I did write them. And four of these are in this collection. I wrote more than that. But once I had written them, I looked around, and I was at a loss for a publisher. And at the time, I had been reading. I was in libertarian circles quite a bit, and I was reading a blog by a guy who goes by the name TGGP, and I cannot for the life of me remember what that stands for, but he had a blog called Entitled to an Opinion. And he had, first of all, run an interview with Chip, and I kind of read Nine Banded Books, and I read the first book Chip put out, or one of the first, which is by L.A. Rollins, and it's called The Myth of Natural Rights. But in itself, it was more of an anthology of L.A. Rollins' writings. He had his version of the Devil's Dictionary, which is called Lucifer's Lexicon, and just a bunch of other writings about Holocaust denial and other matters. And I just thought that was the coolest thing I'd ever seen. So naturally, I was interested to see if I could get on, because that seemed to be my best alternative at this point. Because I could not find another publisher, you know, interested in tackling even the milder stories that I had written. And consequently, Chip's been a wonderful editor and a really good publisher, in my opinion.
And Andy Nowicki, who also writes short stories, he wrote the introduction. He wrote the introduction to it. What can you say about the introduction that Andy wrote?
I quite enjoy Andy's writing, and I'm really flattered by it, but honestly, I think he, if anything, I'm just kind of overwhelmed by it. I really have to give Andy a lot of credit as a writer, and I will say that I have not always felt that way about his writing. I didn't care for his first novel. And
are you talking about Under the Nihil?
Under the Nihil, and I wasn't particularly impressed with that work, but since then it bears repeated reading, and I think a lot of his books are going to have a lot of stamina, and they're going to be appreciated long term. You know, I don't know how much people are going to read in the future. I think illiteracy is on the horizon, and the novel is, and the written word is largely going to disappear within the next 50 years. But I could be grossly off base there. But I do believe Andy's works will last. He's a Catholic writer. I classify him as a Catholic writer, and there are a lot of Catholic writers that were very influential to me, and I see him as kind of like Evelyn Waugh and Alice Thomas Ellis. Not many people have read her works, but in this country at least. But she was a bestseller in England for quite some time, and she's a really superlative author. And I kind of feel Andy just keeps plugging away. He's put out more content certainly than I have in the last few years, and I think he's going to become more than a cult author. I think he's going to have a massive impact long term on the literary the literary scene and on the whole cultural war as it is still being waged by certain parts of the alternative right, as they call themselves, and other branches.
Yeah, most of his... So you're saying that right now, I'd say the majority of his following is within the alternative right, but you see a lot of...
I think it will expand.
Yeah. I think you're right.
I think he will have a significant impact on the younger generation, such as it is of those young men that are putting out their books, and those young men who read will be more inclined to read Andy Nowicki. I'll put it that way.
And you're relatively young. I mean, how old are you if you want to say your age? You don't have to.
I'm under 30.
Okay. So am I. And what is the significance of the title, Down Where the Devil Don't Go?
I wrote it in an underground warehouse, and it was unoccupied at the time and dark and all that, so it's kind of a joke, if anything. But it's more than a joke, actually. It's one of those areas where the right has kind of gotten into a position where, and I don't consider it myself necessarily a right-winger, but certainly not a left-winger, not a liberal. But the right has gotten into a position where it's people on the alternative right are willing to go into areas or aspects of human nature, humanity, that no one else wants to touch, that are untouchable, unapproachable, that are walled off, cloistered, allowed to remain in darkness. And these areas that the right is willing to shine a light into, to explore, to try to understand areas of human nature, human biodiversity, what have you, understanding, being willing to consider bringing back the ideas, resurrecting the ideas of the past and instituting them in the future, this is all part of what I call, you know, going beyond where the devil wants to go, or wants us to go, certainly.
So yeah, that is the theme of the title. I get what you're saying, and I guess we can talk about some of the stories. I'll start off with so I read the well. First of all, there's a review up by James O'Mara up on a Countercurrents, and I think that is the main. That is probably the main review of the book that's up so far.
Yeah, I haven't. I'm planning to ship a lot of copies off to other book reviewers in not too long, but there hasn't been another one. I quite enjoyed James's reviews. I'm one of James's biggest fans, and I believe I have the honor of being the first one to interview him on the air back about 4 or 5 years ago. I think in a couple of I like James's review, but I think he misses the mark in a couple of areas. I take his criticism very much to heart. I think it's very constructive, but partially dealing with the two stories, he kind of misses the point. And I wrote these stories on several levels. Population Eyes was written on several levels, and it's not really about a writer who has writer's block, because when you think about it, writer's block is not, if you're in literary circles, nobody will admit to having writer's block. I mean, even if I've never had writer's block, and even if there are people out there who have writer's block, they'd never admit it. The story is about a writer, and I wrote this specifically because I used to listen to NPR a lot in the past, and those individuals who do those short pieces on NPR. And I got to thinking about the life of your typical creative writing instructor, especially a creative writing instructor in the Midwest or South, and often they find themselves, they kind of think they're surrounded by enemies on all sides. They have a novel view of the world around them. And so I'm not really dealing with the blocked writer. I'm dealing with the entire experience of the liberal writer. I'm kind of turning things around in some ways, because liberal writers writing about rightist neuroses is a quite common theme. So I'm just, you know, I probably could be accused of just reversing that and turning it around on the left, as it were. But I think it's more than that. That was not my necessarily my intention. It was also something like probably trying to present a different view of individuals. Again, I'm talking about individuals that ordinarily would not be written about. The only person who would write about a creative writer would be an academic who taught creative writing. Nobody else cares or is interested in a creative writing instructor in a small college. So, you go on to Protocols of the Learned Elders of Hollywood. No one's really interested in a studio exec, in the life of a studio exec, or what his machinations are, unless they have to do with sex, drugs, or something that one could craft a novel around. So I'm taking these figures and taking them out of their regular context, as we might say, and looking at them through the eyes of a different individual or a different writer. And at the time, I had written a novel, a full-length novel. It's quite a large novel, and it's about the war on terrorism. And I'd written this massive novel, and I realized there's no way in hell I can get this thing published. There's no publisher in the world that would take this book. It's not necessarily because it's bad. It's written about this, you know, different style than these stories, but certainly not the worst writing in the world. I've studied creative writing. I've read many books on the subject. I've studied it in depth for over a decade, but the stories are just not in tune with the political outlook of the right or left, so good luck with finding a publisher. So having written that book, I was kind of looking at creative writing and creative writing professors and teachers and the whole publishing industry, and from a jaundiced outlook, and that's how Population I came to be.
Is there...
So I take James' points to heart, but there's more to the Population I and Protocols of the Learned Elders of Hollywood than one might take. It might take repeat reading to kind of develop or understand the whole thesis of these stories.
Is there anything in reference to politics in the books, in the series?
There's nothing specifically in reference to parties or politics or anything like that, but I generally wrote the stories from the perspective of what we might call a Tory anarchist perspective. I don't consider myself a Tory anarchist, but it's written from a Tory anarchist perspective. It's sardonic. It's somewhat Nietzschean. It's certainly interested in the tragic. It's interested in people. It's not so respectful of societal mores, middle class societal mores, but it's not at the same time in any way a liberal outlook, certainly. But as far as mainstream politics, it has, you know, no connection to such things.
Is there something? There's one of the characters.
I'm not trying to put out a political.
Well, I'm reading.
I'm not trying to put out a political message, basically.
So there is. I'm reading in the James O'Meara review, but it says there's one of the characters is a sadistic skinhead who writes for porn mags. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, I don't consider him sadistic, but he is what he is. It's kind of a pastiche of Jim Goad back in the late 90s when I used to start reading James Goad, and that character is loosely based on James Goad. I'm surprised nobody has has really noticed that it's basically Jim Goad we're talking about.
And that is, so is that one of the side characters? That's not a main character.
No. He's just a, he makes a cameo appearance, as I would put it.
And so,
actually, it's one of those, it's one of those, I guess, I read a lot of Jim Goad back in back when he started publishing, when he got out of prison, and that's basically him, in his own words, directed toward the liberal establishment of writers, because he faced the same problems that I think a lot of writers, of interesting writers, entertaining writers have, that they just simply can't, they're not allowed to break into the mainstream whatsoever, find their audience.
Yeah, I think that is true, because you have a lot of, like you mentioned Andy Nowicki, some of these writers, because they're affiliated with certain political philosophical stuff, that would be sort of a barrier for them to get their work published by a mainstream publisher.
Yeah, and it's a quite prolific problem. It's all over the place. I could have certainly shopped around for a larger publisher than Nine Banded Books, but I'm quite happy with the limited release this work is getting with Nine Banded Books, because not only is it the only deal in town, I think Nine Banded Books is going to be a cult publisher down the road a ways, and it's going to be something cool. And if you're going to do something, you might as well make it cool.
Is there anything else you would like to add about the book that we didn't touch on?
Chip asked me some questions about the book, and I'd written these stories in 2005, 2006. I just finished a full-length novel. As I said, I wanted to write some short stories because I realized, having written this giant novel, that it's not giant, but it's a good size, that people don't have the attention spans really to handle these big novels anymore. I need to write now is some short stories. So I wrote maybe a dozen short stories, and I sent some of them to Chip, and got these published. And I don't know, the stories are, the way I put it is, they are what they are. It may not be, it's not possible to accept them at face value, because that's not, it's just impossible to do. They are, without blowing my own horn, I'm not saying I'm the greatest writer in the world, that's not what I'm saying here, but I wrote these stories in a specific manner to appeal to the reader and to get a point across. It's not a political point, but it does have a point for the reader to discern. And that's pretty much all I can say for the stories.
So you have a radio podcast, which is relatively new, on a talk show, but it's called American Onslaught. Can you tell us about that, and what is...
I've been doing the American Onslaught to broadcast so off and on for years, but Daryl over at Facebook has pretty much been after me to do broadcasts on a regular basis. And if he's going to wrangle me guests, well, I'll interview guests. I like doing interviews. I think I did one of the first interviews with Matt Parrott some time ago, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, too, and several other individuals before they became well-known on the alternative right. But I enjoy doing interviews. American Onslaught is... probably going to be expanded later on. I'm very interested in radio. The problem with internet radio is that, of course, outreach is big issue, and I'm not really a self-promoter, but we'll be growing, and if you do it steadily, you get an audience. I've been involved in trying to actually purchase a radio station in the past, and in the Ozark area, and manage it, but the problem, there's a huge number of problems related to that, and one of the initial problems we had was our backers didn't necessarily like the lineup of hosts that we were going to potentially have on this radio show picking up. Sorry, go ahead.
Can you say who some of those hosts are?
We were hoping to carry or broadcast the Political Cesspool and a few other shows like that. James Edwards' outfit out of Memphis, Tennessee, I believe it is. And I had a kind of a list there, but of course the backers must have Googled them. I don't think they'd ever heard of James Edwards or some of these other guys before on internet radio or satellite radio, but that deal kind of fell through. And the other part of the deal was that the guy I was going in on it didn't really understand my interest in culture. He wanted the station to be wholly dealing with the political talk radio, daytime news talk radio, whereas I wanted to have a more cultural talk radio type deal and play more music, do things like that, interview musicians, have a mix between news talk and NPR is the way I would put it, something like that, but with a conservative rightist bent. And basically, I would say that we all had the same goal in that we wanted to get the radio station, but what we wanted to do with it was drastically different. That's the reason things didn't work out, I'd say.
Is American Onslaught, is it affiliated with the gangster Bolshevik movement?
Well, there are gangster Bolsheviks on it. It's not really affiliated. They have their own gangster Bolshevik broadcasting show. I'm interested in a lot of political movements that I'm not necessarily a part of or eligible to belong to, but I just have an interest in politics.
What do you mean by eligible?
Well, I don't feel qualified to belong to. I'm obviously half white, so I wouldn't, of course, be eligible to be white nationalist or something like that.
So what is your
I am interested in white nationalism.
What is your other half of your background?
I'm white and an American Indian.
But you're willing to interview those kind of people.
Yeah, I'm very interested in... it's not just white nationalism. I'm also interested in the resurgence of the American Indian movement. I'm interested in black nationalists that are interested in returning to Africa and starting a movement there. A few years ago, I joked around and said I tried to get American whites to go back to Europe and the American blacks to go back to Africa and leave the continent to the mixed bloods, and we'll run things on what you might call the half-bloods or what have you.
We'll
run things because the full-bloods aren't quite up to it. Sorry, go ahead.
You know, I interviewed this guy on my radio show. He goes by the name Bay Area Guy, and he was kind of joking, but he was saying his friends who are mixed race are actually some of the most politically incorrect people he knows.
Well, the interesting thing about being mixed race is that, especially if you're about 50-50 like I am, is that you... understand certain things about genetics, and you understand certain things about genetic impact on you. You can feel a bit bipolar sometimes, and I've actually studied quite a lot about interracial the science of interracial beings. I think a lot of miscegenation leads to mental illness in the individual. Honestly, I'm not saying I'm mentally ill or I've experienced that problem, but I do believe from my studies that it's led to mental illness, and also I think it kind of creates a split personality in some ways. And this is very politically incorrect to say, you know, even whites would have a problem with it, because I think it's more than just a white or black or white or an Indian or white or an Asian individual. It can also be various white ethnicities that cause certain forms of mental imbalances when they are intermarried. Because in the past, you talked about the great white races. There are white races, in my view, and everybody knows this. You have the Nords and the Meds and so on, different forms, the Slavs, the Teutons, and the Anglo-Saxons. You know, I can't list them all off the top of my head, but the point is that certain intermixtures, you take a Slav and an Irishman, we don't necessarily...
Yeah, I mean, I'm personally a mixture of a lot of those different groups you mentioned, like Scandinavian, Polish, Irish, German. But I think that's the norm for a large portion of Americans.
Most Americans are, and what we have an issue in North America right now where North Americans have the highest rate of mental illness, they have the highest rate of obesity, depression, and other illnesses, and I believe this is partially because North America has become a melting pot, not only for the third world races, but also for the first world races. For whites, there was a white melting pot before the third world poured into the United States, and I think that's had a effect on Americans who, you know, will proudly proclaim themselves Mongols. And in some ways, hybridization may be considered good, but you know, the good old American white mongrel, that's not necessarily the ideal situation, in my opinion. Speaking as a mongrel myself, that I believe a lot of I believe I've come around almost to belief in the purity of the blood, because the more heterogeneous people become, the less they can connect to any particular identity, and the more they have those different types of blood sometimes conflicting in their minds, warring with each other potentially in some aspects of their lives and causing them difficulty. So this is just a hypothesis by me, but again, as a mixed blood myself, I have done some research in this, and I'm just speculating that this may well be a cause of some of the difficulty, and it's also some of the reasons whites can't unite in the United States, because they don't have any core identities to unite behind.
I mean, even culture, culture has been watered down so much. A lot of white Americans don't really have much of a culture.
There's no common culture.
Yeah, it's basically just
been a common culture.
Oh, it's just all this consumerism and all this pop culture garbage.
At one time, you know, we're all supposed to celebrate St. Patrick's Day. Well, I've had my DNA tested, and I don't have any Irish in me at all. So there's no way, you know, why should I celebrate St. Patrick's Day even if I were white?
It's like Cinco de Mayo. It's more about an excuse to go out and get hammered.
That's correct. But again, there is no core American white identity or white culture in the United States. You have a diversity of white cultures. You have German, Irish, some Swedish, different Italians, but you don't have a one overall overarching white American culture or identity. And that's why I think people are at a loss to coalesce, for something to coalesce around. And that's one of the biggest problems, in my opinion. And I have had considerable experience observing various white groups, both in person and on the internet, and talk to a great number of people. And that seems to be the principal problem. If you can't unite around something common, then you know you're out of luck. You know, you can't get people to follow just ideology, certainly.
And you mentioned to me earlier that you were doing research on different communities in the Ozarks.
Yes, communitarianism, I don't like the word communitarianism. Communitarianism first came to my attention because my mentor was a gentleman named William Roberts, who passed away in January of this year. He had the Get Vocal Local radio show on Oracle Broadcasting before it folded in 2012. And he was quite an astute political thinker, and unfortunately he never put out a book or anything, but he was quite well known in property rights circles having to do with land ownership and tax freedom movements from the 90s. He was briefly affiliated with David Duke, but he hasn't had any affiliation with any groups or since then. But Will made the point that one of his points that this communitarianism that is being spread by numerous liberal and internationalist organizations is artificial. It's not a genuine communitarianism because they're essentially creating plastic communities, and they're the whole purpose of what they call Agenda 21 that Glenn Beck finally heard about and uses on his show to scare the old geezers who listen to him. The whole point of Agenda 21 is to create these new model communities that are essentially synthetic, and of people who are plasticized and put into these communities. So what I was interested in doing was studying communities, the remnant of communities that exist. Now, in Southwest Missouri, we have a few communities left that are organic. We have Mennonites who are slowly becoming more, losing their unique old world flavor. We have the Amish who are being technologically inundated and watered down. Their own lifestyle is being watered down by technology, though they still retain a lot of their old ways. And it seems to me, actually, that the Amish, and both the Amish and Mennonite women, are more resilient than the men to the cultural changes. But then you also have some organic communities of individuals who have lived in Southwest Missouri for over 100 years. We have a lot of century farms. Some of them are in operation, and some of them are not in operation, but they exist to this day, and the family has lived on that land for over 100 years. And there's a barn on a property that I work on that is over 120 years old. It's standing up pretty darn good, made out of white oak logs, and it was one of those barns they created at the turn of the 19th to the 20th century. And the people who built it, their ancestors still live in that same valley and still run cattle. There's still something of the clannish mentality remaining in the Ozark region. And so it's interesting to study and see what traditions remain and what the remnant of all that is the impact of that, of those traditions have on people. Now, I like to say that the U.S. government is waging biological war upon the old stock American people, because if you think about it, people used to like to talk about the pioneer origins of the United States, and I would interview a lot of elderly people in their 80s and 90s when I was in my teens, and talk about how their ancestors had come to this area in covered wagons, and gotten settled on the land, and built their houses and built their barns, and farmed the land. And since then, a lot of those people, their descendants have either left the land, been driven off of it by the basically remained on the land, and those individuals, you can see they're under attack at this moment. Partially it's because of banking practices, and partially it's because of health issues, because one thing you'll see is very prevalent in Missouri, as in much of the rural South, is that obesity is a huge problem, and you'll notice it affects certain types of people more than others. It affects a lot of the old stock Celtic stock, Scotch-Irish stock, particularly. And I'm interested in studying types of people, studying family names and things like that, seeing diseases they're prone to. I'm interested in seeing, since the Great Recession, what we've seen in a lot of little communities is that the folks will, basically everybody will come back to grandma and granddad's homestead because they can't afford to live in town, or they can't afford to pay the rent, so they'll come and get a mobile home and put it on granddad's back 40 and live there, and they might help him with the livestock. So you'll have folks who own maybe 120 acres, and there'll be a whole family will come home and live on that land, and they'll commute to work every day. And you see that quite often in the remaining communities that are able to survive the current onslaught, because but they have the advantage of having factories to work in, like the chicken processing plant. Now, in eastern Missouri, they are more or less out of luck, because the only remaining industry is logging in eastern Missouri, and a lot of counties over in the southeast. And consequently, the result is that a lot of those counties are being depopulated en masse. You have Texas County, one of the largest counties in Missouri. It's over 1,200 square miles, has a population of less than 20,000. And so it's quite interesting to see the individuals in these communities begin to lose their identity slowly. Part of it is the influx of country radio, the TV impact on them, the deleterious influence of Walmart, and partially it's due down to the food they eat. Everything is determined to destroy their identity. But once a person's individual identity or family identity or racial identity is destroyed, it's more than that. They have lost their political identity beforehand, and people lose their political identity in Southwest Missouri because they don't have property. They don't have a connection to the town they grew up in necessarily. People will go to a high school reunion, but they won't vote because they feel a certain kinship or nostalgia for that high school, those high school towns, but they don't have much of a nostalgia for the small town or community they grew up in, and consequently they may live in there all their lives and never vote. That's what we see with the 18 to 45-year-old demographic, which is the Generation X and Generation Y, which I call Generation Faggot and Generation Maggot, is often unwilling to become politically involved because they don't have that sense of identity or investment in the community.
And the other issue, you're also involved with, you're a proponent of public banking and infrastructure and utilities reform.
Well, it all goes back to the original part of having a autonomous region. You have to have your own money. You have to keep it in your own banks. I think the reputation of the Bank of North Dakota is quite well known and how well it works. That can be duplicated on a county level. And I'm in the process of introducing that idea. I just gave a talk on it last night throughout my county in Missouri, and kind of making people aware of it and discussing this with our candidates and using my organization to promote this public banking option. Basically, people don't realize where do the tax dollars go. When they bank tax dollars, what banks do they put them in? They put them in the same banks basically take people's money and just ship it right up to Wall Street for use in private investment. And public funds, of course, should not be used for private investment. And the other issue there is that, of course, people are trying, public officials are constantly trying to wring every dollar in tax money out of the population, and they have no choice but to do this because the way the situation is now, you have a situation where they are desperate for money. It's either federal money or it's local tax dollars. And federal money, most grants and aid require matching pledges from the local government. You have to give so much money, and they'll match you with a grant, but you have to put up so much money or float a bond or what have you. And consequently, what happens is that they are at a loss for ways to come up with enough money to maintain enough public funds to maintain the basic public works projects of roads, bridges, public buildings, and so on. And right now, of course, in our schools, our system in Missouri is not connected to the local tax base. They get their money from the state, or they're under the state. They're under state tax jurisdiction, but the county commission public works department is all funded by sales tax in my county. So I feel that public banking is the ideal option to ascertain that those dollars stay within the county, within the state, and those public funds stay within the county and stay within the state, and that they can also be used as tax credits, as money available to banks to generate interest, to generate loan material and credit, interest-free credit as well. So that's interest-free credit is the other positive aspect of these banks and why they're really needed at this time, because all the money, as you're well aware, and I think most of your listeners would be well aware, all the money that Bernanke has printed has gone into the big banks, and it's not really trickled down into the smaller small-town banks and rural banks of the Midwest and the South.
Yeah, I get you know what you're saying, because Ron Paul, he is correct that the Federal Reserve is fraudulent, but he doesn't have any solutions to the problem. I mean, he's saying some of the right things about what's wrong, but he doesn't have any solutions, and I think you're right that public banking is a solution to this.
Yes, I used to be an Austrian economist, but I gave up on it because I didn't see the Austrians had any solution to any situation. And this was prior to the Ron Paul 2007 campaign. I just didn't see any, there was not a single Austrian economics writer out there who was capable of doing anything about the economic situation. So I felt it was necessary to turn to other means. Now, Ellen Brown, I don't always agree with either, but she is, of course, the definitive author of the definitive work on public banking in this day and age. But let's not forget that Benjamin Franklin, in Volume 2 of his memoirs, also has a good word to say for public banking.
And you've been involved with some mainstream politics. I know, did you work with Representative Mike Moon?
I had worked with Mike Moon when he ran for Congress the first time, and then he ran for state representative now, and I've been, he's a really good guy, I must say. Mike is an original. I think he will run for higher office, and he's really motivated by Christian principles. I had worked on several campaigns. I'm not going to name all of them. I've been a precinct committee man and worked within the Republican Party, and I worked on both Ron Paul campaigns. Right now, I'm in the process, as of just this very day, of trying to gain control of the Republican Party committee of my county, and I'll know what the score is tomorrow on how we're going to do in the gaining control of the Republican County Committee. I've campaigned on that for last month, and so I'm kind of interested to see how that's going to turn out.
And your upcoming project, you're working on a rock opera.
I'm working on a rock opera, and a lot of people think I'm trolling because I'm a.
Are you going to say what it's
of? Troll, but it's a rock opera based on Mein Kampf, and I went around advertising on Craigslist for about 6 months, and trying to find somebody who would be willing to work with me on this project, a composer. And I can't mention his name because not everybody wants to be in the forefront. This gentleman recognized it as an artistic project and was willing to go with me on this. Now, I don't really have a problem with Hitler, and I'm not trying to troll. This is not springtime for Hitler type deal. If anything,
so it's not going to be like the producers with what's it called, Nathan? Well, the original, there was the original one with Mel Brooks, but there was a remake with Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick. It's not going to be like that.
Yeah, no. It's, if anything, it's a little bit serious, and just it's kind of. I don't really go into the politics a whole lot. What my interest in is in. Will Roberts would always tell me about Hitler was that he knew who he was and whose he was. And I think that's something that most people on the right can't say today. Most people don't know who they are and whose they are. And I'm not here to tell you, you know, who or whom that, you know, one is supposed to belong to or who one should be. But I know one has to know that in their own heart before they can go ahead with any grand project or any project at all of political magnitude. Because you can't convince people of your views unless you know who you are and whose you are.
Well, it is probably you're probably going to have a hard time getting the actors and the singers.
It's going to be a bitch, honestly. But I'm looking forward to it because that's been one of the problems I've had writing plays in the past. I've written lines in novels and plays and stuff, and suddenly I woke up one day and I realized who would possibly I know some actors, and this goes back to Population I again, because I'm describing those people in the theater today. It's a very gay, and I don't mean to necessarily be homophobic here. That's not my intent. A lot of times, it's like a Hammerlock song lyric. It's called snide little faggot, ain't necessarily gay. Just a condescending punk with nothing good to say. And I can't imagine my lines being said by the type of snide little faggots who write or who act in a lot of theater productions these days, female and male. And so that's a problem. That's a huge problem, but we're going to surmount that problem, even if I have to use puppets like that German director in one of Jonathan Bowden talks about in one of his lectures. We'll plan to stage this play, but part of the play is, of course, the music. And I can actually send out CDs of some of the songs we've written, because the music, you know, the songs are focused on the aspect of Hitler as the dreamer, Hitler thinking of the future. Hitler imagining what the future could be, Hitler being led, into the future. And, Hitler said he dreamed a lot. And it was one of the motivations for accomplishment. And so Dreamwalker, for example, is one of the songs. And it's based on dreams and the idea of how dreams and ambitions and so on affect individuals.
So, Paul, I'd like to thank you. That was Paul Bingham. I'd like to thank you for being on the show.
Well, thank you for having me, Robert.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.